Welcome to this evening. I'm John Adams. I'm chairman of the Foundation for Law, Justice, and Society, the FLJS, as we like to call ourselves, which is sponsoring the lecture this evening. The foundation was founded in Oxford in 2005, and it's affiliated with Oxford University, the Center for Social Legal Studies, and Wolfson College, in which we house our offices. Its purpose is to study, reflect, and promote on the understanding of the role of law in contemporary social issues. And its purpose further is to bridge the gap between academia and policy and decision makers. More information about us can be found on fljs.org. Consistent with our mandate today, tonight and tomorrow morning, we're conducting a workshop examining the challenges to liberal constitutions now being seen in Western Europe and the United States. And this evening, we are pleased to present a lecture by Professor Galligan on the constitutional crisis of 2016. Before we hear from him, though, these debates aren't new. In fact, some 350 years ago in a church, St. Mary's Church in Putney, shortly outside London, there was a debate among the various combatants in the English Civil War on what kind of a government should exist in the United Kingdom. The levelers proposed that those debates many what we would call now democratic ideals. And they debated seriously for 3 days until finally Cromwell got impatient and dismissed everyone. But the UK now questions its post-referendum future, and our foundation is what we call in our brochure that which you can get outside restaging the Putney debates of some 370 years ago. But I want to assure you it's not a redressing of it, but it is a readdressing of it, where prominent people, members of the media, and professors and the like will redebate these issues. And it is going to be on the 2nd and 3rd of February of 2017, and it is being popularly subscribed, so I encourage you to pick up a flyer outside and to attend the debates. Well, as I said, Professor Galligan is going to give us a lecture now on the Constitution crisis in 2016. As you probably know, Professor Galligan is the Professor of Social Legal Studies here at Oxford, is a director of the Foundation of Law, Justice, and Society, is a professional fellow of Wolfson's College, who has been instrumental, among other things, for the Foundation in directing, and very importantly, our study in the science of constitutions. His lecture will be about 45 to 50 minutes, and after that we'll have a short question and hopefully good answer period afterwards with Professor Galligan. Professor?
Well, thank you, John. Good evening, everyone. I'm going to give you a lecture this evening on the constitutional crisis of 2016. I should have added an historical perspective, because I'm going to particularly try to understand the crisis in the context of the history of the crisis. So, following the referendum earlier this year as to whether the United Kingdom should remain in the European Union, the Constitution has become the centre of public attention in a way not seen for over a century. Several issues have arisen: the status of the referendum, the authority of Parliament, the power of the executive, and the rightful role of the courts. Each of these contains matters of interest and concern. All have provoked opinions and reactions, as unexpected as they are in some cases, rather crude and ignorant in sentiment. But the issue of utmost constitutional importance, the issue at the very core of the Constitution, is the status of the people and their relationship to Parliament. David Hume, the philosopher, historian, social theorist, writing in the 18th century, observed, and I quote, "Nothing appears more surprising to those who consider human affairs with a philosophical eye than the easiness with which the many are governed by the few, and the implicit submission with which men resign their own sentiments to those of their rulers." Hume went on to say, it's all the more curious when you consider that power, raw power, is always on the side of the governed. For, he wrote, the governors have nothing to sustain them but opinion. It is on opinion only that government is founded. A constitution depends on self-restraint of the people. Self-restraint in not exerting their natural liberty, accepting instead the standards set by the Constitution for the conduct of government. Hume thought two conditions necessary and adequate for self-restraint and acquiescence. One is that the people are inclined to fall in with the settled way of doing things. The other, the more substantial, is provision of what he called the necessities of life. If the system ensures the necessities of life, that is essentially security of person and property, the people will exercise self-restraint and accept the Constitution. Questions may be raised about Hume's claim, which is ultimately causal and empirical. Whether it takes account of the people's concern to be ruled according to certain values and in certain ways is not clear. Nor does it seem to take account of people's inextinguishable desire to have some say in how they are ruled, some part in ruling. But Hume's not my subject tonight. Rather, inspired by Hume, I want to examine the ruler-ruled relationship in the British historical context. Is there a crisis of the Constitution? The title of this lecture ought to end with a question mark. For what does it mean to talk of a crisis of the Constitution? I take it to mean simply, first, established principles of the Constitution are under question, and secondly, there is no plan or vision for resolving or answering the question. English history is rich in constitutional crises. One of the most important was 1647, in the wake of the Civil War. Similarities with the present are not wholly fanciful. Old constitutional certainties in relations between king, peers, and commons were overturned. The king was in captivity, the House of Lords abolished, the House of Commons in disarray. No one was quite sure what to do, how to re-establish the constitution and ensure effective government. The Putney debates, to which John Adams made reference in October 1647, perhaps the closest we have had to a constitutional convention, ended in confusion and contention, out of which Oliver Cromwell was able to seize power and govern for a decade as a kind of dictator we would now condemn. And yet, the crisis of the 1640s opened the way for, made possible, set in train, the creation of the constitutional order we now have. The House of Commons, being the only elected part of the Constitution, was able to assert, in the name of the people, superiority over king and peers. This was a novel idea, but it worked. The House of Commons, itself, on the whole, composed of the upper class, had its own motives, and neither intended nor foresaw the consequences of its actions. But once having acted in the name of the people, as the elected representative of the people, once having proclaimed the people as the foundation of constitutional authority, there was no turning back. Along the road to a modern constitution, the 1640s were, in my view, a turning point. That the people are in some sense the foundation of constitutional authority is true, as we saw with Hume. That is a political reality. The parliamentarians turned that political reality into a constitutional principle to their advantage. But it was double-edged. On the one hand, it gave parliamentarians a constitutional advantage over king and peers. On the other hand, in empowering the people, in accepting perhaps for the first time that they have a distinct place in the constitution, the parliamentarians unleashed a mighty force. A force the full unfolding of which would potentially lead to popular democracy, an unthinkable outcome. It had to be contained. And much of constitutional history since is about its containment. To the extent there is now a crisis, it is about that same issue. The place of the people in the constitution, the place of the people in relation to parliament. Constitutions provide the framework of government, the rules and institutions. They are artificial constructions, created by one generation and inherited by another. They are neither timeless nor unchanging. Being artificial, constitutions on occasions fall out of step with society and politics, and hence opinion. Jeremy Bentham thought each generation should review the constitution to bring it into line with contemporary opinion. Indeed, the average life of a constitution nationally across the globe is 19 years. Constitutions should not, however, change with the wind. For the wind, as with attitudes, can blow in different directions in the same day. The constitution, in providing stable and effective government, is meant to protect against the whims of the day, the fickleness of the press, the fashionable ideas no more permanent than the seasons, especially when such ideas encourage intolerance and oppression, the very things the constitution is meant to protect against. We need not fear change, but change creates uncertainty and incurs risk. To avoid risk, we should first understand what we have now and how it came about. And that is my present purpose. Since you are surely familiar with recent events, I need not go into the details. Focusing on relations between Parliament and the people, we should be clear about a few points. The sovereignty of Parliament is a fundamental principle of the Constitution and has been for centuries. Within the trinity of monarch, peers, and commons, the House of Commons is the main part. The powers of the Queen and Lords gradually have diminished as those of the House of Commons have increased, so that it now has the final say on matters of law and policy. It must act as it considers best in the public interest for the common good. Among the many processes for gauging opinions of the people, petitions, addresses, grievances, and so on, the referendum has traditionally had no place. If considered a modern successor or addition to those other processes, the referendum raises no constitutional problem. Parliament has a duty to consider it, take it into account, and decide what weight to give to it, the final decision being Parliament's. If Parliament considers a referendum is binding on it, regardless of whether a majority of members judge the outcome to be in the best interests of the nation, then there is a dilemma. Parliament might try to escape the dilemma by holding the outcome to be in the national interest just because that is the opinion of a majority of those voting. That would be to accept, in effect, that the referendum is binding. To accept the referendum as binding would be a change of constitutional principle. Whether it's a good one or not is not my present concern, but it would be a change. It would be an abdication of Parliament's responsibility to determine what is best for the nation, all things considered. In allowing the people to decide directly a matter of immense importance to the nation, would be to compromise both parliamentary authority and the principle of representative democracy on which it is based. That would be a constitutional change of considerable moment. But you may be wondering, what's the problem? We live in a democracy. A democracy means constitutional authority derives from the people. And the people should have the final say on matters of moment. We elect representatives to act on our behalf, but we are the principals, they're the agents, the delegates. As principals, why should we not, from time to time, reclaim our original authority? These are elementary questions that require serious consideration. The introduction of elements of direct democracy, that is to say, allowing the people to have more direct say over how they are governed, is a common feature of many constitutions. You may think the more direct democracy, the better. The merits and demerits of more direct democracy and less reliance on representatives are issues of great importance and of pressing need. They raise matters of high principle and practical consequences. They are not, however, my concern in this lecture. That is simply to understand how the Constitution as it now is, to understand better the Constitution as it now is and how it came about. I consider four issues. First, how the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty became the foundation of the Constitution. Secondly, the place and meaning of democracy in the historical Constitution. Thirdly, the relationship between parliamentary sovereignty and representative democracy. And finally, the relationship between politics and the Constitution. The nature and origin of parliamentary sovereignty. According to Nigel Farage, that well-known authority, the ruling of the High Court on the use of the prerogative to trigger leaving the European Union, according to Nigel, is an affront to the sovereignty of the people, sovereignty of the people. While this captures the mood of some, to others, the concept of the sovereignty of the people is alien to the British Constitution. Here we have sovereignty of Parliament, not the people. Among national constitutions globally, especially those broadly democratic, the sovereignty of the people is proclaimed as the foundation of constitutional authority. Around a quarter of national constitutions, of which there are 200, we the people, they begin with those words, we the people, who go on to recite the constitution they have proudly made. What could be a more confident display of popular sovereignty? From that, the rest follows. Parliament and the executive in such systems owe their authority to the people. Parliamentary sovereignty does not exist. The British exception is written off as an anachronism peculiar to British history and temperament and in line with the stubborn refusal to adopt a constitutional text. To this account must be entered two reservations. Despite we the people, the sovereignty of the people turns out to be not quite what is claimed. In many cases, the people are not sovereign at all in those constitutions. They are instead the source of sovereignty. Note that, the source of sovereignty, while sovereignty itself is vested in either the nation or in the institutions of government or both. The Republic of Turkey might not be the obvious model to cite here, but its constitution captures the idea precisely and with some elegance. The people are the source of sovereignty, it says. Sovereignty is vested in the nation. Sovereignty is exercised by the institutions of government. Notice that trilogy, that division of sovereignty. Many other constitutions have that exact structure while lacking the precision. When sovereignty is analysed in this way, the UK is not so different. It was commonplace throughout constitutional history to acknowledge the people as the ultimate source of political authority, while sovereignty itself is vested in the realm, which became the King in Parliament. For constitutional theorists such as Hobbes, John Locke, Adam Smith, among many others, it was assumed that ultimate power lies with the people, that constitutional authority finally depends on the support of the people. And recall David Hume, a constitutional order depends on the self-restraint of the people, self-restraint in the exercise, in the exertion of their raw power. It is correct to say that in any constitutional order, the people are, in this political, practical sense, sovereign. Now, in grasping the distinction between the source of sovereignty and the bearer of sovereignty, it helps to keep clear the distinction between the constitutional domain and the political. First, by political action of the people, a constitutional order is created. Once created, it has its own logic and method, and is distinct from the political. Second, notice that sovereignty, in relation to the Constitution, is a legal concept. The power of the people, on the other hand, is a political fact. As political fact, the people have final power, while as a constitutional doctrine, Parliament is sovereign. The concept of parliamentary sovereignty and the language to express it are of fairly recent origin. But the idea of the King in Parliament as the supreme constitutional authority is as ancient as the English Constitution. As early as 1322, just to take an example, the Statute of York makes reference to Parliament as the King, Earls, Barons, and Prelates, the Bishops, and the commonalty of the realm, the people, the common people. John Fortescue in the 15th century drew a line between dominium regale from the dominium politicum et regale. In other words, the absolute king who ruled as he wished, as opposed to the constitutional monarch who ruled through parliament. By the time of the Tudors, a dynasty inclined to absolutist tendencies, the king in parliament was accepted as the final authority in the realm. Only later does sovereignty become the term to describe that constitutional reality. But a word of caution. We should hesitate in reading back into history modern concepts and modern language. To the medieval and early modern mind, sovereignty was not the issue. The logic was different. The realm, the nation, was constituted by the three estates, monarch, magnates, and commons. That the three should come together in a complex relationship flowed naturally from the organic nature of the society and, once together, signified its unity. I emphasize unity. The body politic modeled itself on the body natural. The king was the head, but without the other organs, the other estates, the body could not function and would be powerless. Only through corporate unity could the common weal, the common good, be advanced and the body politic enjoy good health. John of Salisbury, reflecting on the organic constitution in the 12th century, gave graphic account of the body politic. The head the king, the arms the military, the belly the tax collectors went up and down, and so on, while the common people naturally were the feet. John goes on to say that if the feet stop working, the body will be left to crawl along on its belly, an ignominious fate. The body can work well only if the feet, he went on to say, are well shod. For there is nothing worse, he warned, than a barefoot republic. So events of the 17th century, the Civil War, destruction and chaos, the Commonwealth of Cromwell, the restoration of the Stuarts, and then the Glorious Revolution, shattered what remained of that medieval organic unity of the realm. The beneficiary was the House of Commons. Its authority swelled while that of King and Peers shrank. The process, which had begun in the 1640s, ended in the early 20th century with the House of Commons emerging as the dominant and effective part of the Queen in Parliament, the other two parts being rendered essentially ornaments, adornments. We saw how that process began with the House of Commons' contention that, being the elected chamber, the only elected part of Parliament, it had a foundation for its authority lacking in the other two, one an hereditary monarch, the other a mixture of the unelected and the aristocracy. As the right to vote was extended to the people between the 18th century and the 20th, the Commons' case for dominance further strengthened and became unstoppable. Progress from organic unity to the hegemony of the Commons was gradual. Organic unity gave way to the mixed and balanced constitution. From being united in an organic union, the three branches of government were now locked in competition, each seeking a role in government, each checking and containing the other. Charles I, in 1642, in his last reply to Parliament before declaring war, acknowledged the distinct and separate role of the Commons, albeit a rather limited one, perhaps for the first time. He wrote, or it was written on his behalf, "The House of Commons, an excellent conserver of liberty, but never intended for any share in government, or the choosing of them that should govern. The House of Commons is solely concerned with the levies of money, that is, tax, which is the sinews as well of peace as of war." From that modest position, the House of Commons has over time moved from its role as defender of liberty, whatever that meant in the 17th century, to the supreme lawmaker and the overseer of the executive. So what is the place then of democracy in the Constitution? To many, the progression I have just described of the House of Commons is considered right and welcome. That the House of Commons, the elected branch, should prevail over and render obsolete the unelected branches, together with the class structure they stand for, is surely a right response in the age of democracy. The Commons, the ordinary people now, through their representatives, rule themselves. Hume's question, you might think, has lost its point. The many are no longer ruled by the few, but rule themselves. The republican dream of a self-governing people has been achieved. Democracy has prevailed. These are lofty ideals. Let's consider what foundations they have in the British case and what they mean in practice. In 1559, John Aylmer, in defending the possible ascendancy of a woman to the throne, something pretty unusual in the 16th century, wrote as follows, preparing the way so that arguing that having a woman on the throne would not actually change much. He wrote, "The regimen of England is not a mere monarchy, nor a mere oligarchy, nor democracy, but a rule mixed of all these three. In the Parliament House you shall find these three estates, the king or queen, the noblemen, and the burgesses and knights, which represents the democracy." Very early use of the word democracy in constitutional contexts. It's hard to date exactly the emergence of Parliament in the form that Aylmer has just described. He was writing 30 years after the Reformation, in the design and enforcement of which Parliament proved most useful and most important. By involving the House of Commons, and through it the people, the transformation could better be justified and managed. Two issues warrant consideration in the light of this. One, the nature of the democratic element to which Charles and Aylmer and others made reference. The other, to its origins. Now, according to Charles Stuart, King Charles I, each of the three forms of constitution, monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy, have their conveniences and inconveniences, as he put it. Experience and wisdom have taught us how to mix the three, quote, without the inconveniences of any one. And he goes on to say, as long as the balance hangs even between the three estates, if anyone dominates, evil follows. From monarchy, it is tyranny. Aristocracy leads to faction and division. Democracy to tumults, violence, and licentiousness. You get that idea again and again. Tumults, violence, and licentiousness. The goods of each are just as plain. Monarchy unites the nation by providing security abroad and against insurrection at home. Aristocracy is the provision of counsel by the ablest in the realm. Democracy is, quote, liberty and the courage and industry which liberty begets. Charles goes on to add a word of warning about democracy. Take away subordination and degree, he wrote, and the people become the mob. The mob leads to such horrors as levelling of estates, loss of rights and property, and the distinction of families, which is bound to result, and I quote, in the dark, equal chaos of confusion and the long line of our noble ancestors in a Jack Cade or a Wat Tyler, the two great rogues of medieval history. Note the warning. The people must obey the Constitution, for, he goes on, nothing stands between them and that dark chaos of confusion, but the maintenance of the balance which men have made, that is, the mixed constitution, with the three organs balancing each other. Left to themselves, that is, in a strong and direct democracy, the people are doomed to that fate. This was not new. The king was repeating an established line of constitutional thought. The people, although the foundation of a society, act responsibly through their representatives. But left to themselves, they know not how to govern, and soon sink into the mob. A century later, these words were echoed in the mind of Edmund Burke and his contemporaries as they witnessed the mob howling through the streets of Paris. Similar scenes on the docks of Boston haunted John Adams, not this John Adams, the other one, and influenced the design of the new constitutional order. The democratic element that King Charles, John Aylmer, and many others describe was one part of the mixed constitution, but a thin and mean part at that. The democratic credentials of the House of Commons consisted in its being elected, but election by a small section of the adult population, and in conditions that were not always fair and open. Several features of this situation are worth noting. Historically, there is no sense at this time of the people governing themselves. The king and his advisers govern, while the House of Commons is there, as we saw, to be a moderating force on government, a moderating force, the protector of liberty. Secondly, this was a form of representative democracy of a kind far removed from any sense of direct engagement of the people in affairs of state. Representatives, once elected, were not the agents or delegates of electors, nor could they act on direction or instruction from electors. Their duty was to serve the common good, the well-being of the nation. That the connection between this sense of democracy and the people is slight and tenuous is made plain when we consider its origins. This democratic element was not born of the actions of the people. It did not spring from popular agitation or argument, from popular movements over time. Medieval and early modern English society, like others in Europe, did not work that way. On the contrary, the democratic element of the early constitution originates as a constituent part of the unity of the realm. Notice that, as a constituent part of the unity of the realm. Well, it's a long story, the gist of which is as follows. By the 14th century, the three parts of constitutional authority were in place. The commonalty of the realm, the commons, was one of them. It consisted initially of knights and burghers who were summoned to the king's council, later the king's parliament, and whose duty it was to consent on behalf of the Shire, later the towns and cities, to actions proposed by the King. That was their job, to agree. It was usually on a matter of taxation, where, by established custom, the consent of those affected was required. The consent of bishops and magnates, it came to be acknowledged, was not enough. The commons, the taxpayers, had to consent, which they did through their representatives. Not representatives they chose or elected, but representatives who could consent on their behalf. As a statute of 1340 abolishing a particular form of tax recites, quote, the common assent of the prelates, earls, barons, and other magnates, and the commons of our said realm of England, and that in Parliament. Unquote. What began as consent of the commons was by the 16th century described as a democratic element. And over the following century, the electoral base expanded, but the narrow democratic element remained much the same. Let us now consider the relationship between parliamentary sovereignty and representative democracy. Having seen how the concept of parliamentary sovereignty arose and the place of democracy in the mixed constitution, we should now note the conceptual link between the two, for together they are vital to the contemporary constitution. The link is this. Members of the House of Commons, as representatives of the people, stand in the place of those whom they represent in a singular and particular way. The word representation has several senses and is prone to loose usage. In normal usage, representative is in some sense the agent or delegate of, or spokesman for, the represented, suggesting a relationship of control and direction of the represented over the representative. Representation in the Constitution has a different meaning, completely different meaning. Here the representative becomes, stands in the place of, embodies the represented. Its origins probably lie in the theatre. The actor becomes the character represented. That character no longer exists beyond the actor's representation of him. The word itself holds a secret. We say representation, as if it were one word. More accurately, it is two. It is representation, representing again some other persona. The actor represents the character as he, the actor, thinks fit. The two, the representer and the represented, are merged. The one becomes indistinguishable from the other, the one having no features outside the representation. Parliament, it was said, and it was commonly repeated, represents the people in this sense. Parliament becomes the people. Members of Parliament used to claim that when the Parliament was assembled, meaning the House of Commons in particular, the whole people was there assembled in Parliament. And since representatives constitute the people, the real people are outside Parliament and have no constitutional identity, standing, or voice. Parliamentary sovereignty now makes more sense. It's really a shorthand for the more complex social concepts I've just explained. Since Parliament constitutes the people, the sovereignty of Parliament is the sovereignty of the people. But the people is then the true sovereign. But people in this very special sense that they exist only through and in their representatives. There's another aspect to add. You may be wondering how to make sense of the idea of the people being present in Parliament through their representatives. Well, this again is a long constitutional story. It turns on the distinction between the real people, flesh and blood persons, on the one hand, and a corporate sense of the people, on the other hand. When Parliament claims to constitute the people, it is using people in the corporate sense. The corporate sense derives from Roman law, from the universitas of Roman law, the corporation. The word university is a descendant. the corporation that constitutes the collection of students and teachers. The Italians still say l'Università degli Studi, University of Studies, the Corporation of Studies of Siena, of Firenze, etc. It is a way, the use of this term is a way of creating a distinct entity separate from its members. The modern commercial corporation is another descendant. It has legal identity distinct from its members, its owners. From Roman law to canon law, where it proved useful in solving problems of authority in the church in the medieval period, the corporate concept of the people found its way into secular constitutional thought and proved to be most useful. The medieval king represents, embodies, stands for the realm. He acts for and on behalf of its members, as if they were acting for themselves. As the commons replace the king at the centre of constitutional authority, they, the commons, take on the mantle of representatives of the people, the corporate sense of the people. While this concept would sound strange in the mouth of a modern parliamentarian, the sovereignty of Parliament cannot be understood without it. Finally, on this point, the social dilemma created by this sense of the people, by this double sense of the people, should not be overlooked. The House of Commons, having relied on its link to the real people, having aroused in the real people a sense that they had a place in the Constitution, the House of Commons then had to prevent those real people from taking full control. And much of the issue with the levellers in the 17th century was precisely that. The levellers argued the logic is that if the real people is the foundation of your authority, then we'd better change the constitution accordingly. The corporate notion of the people is a fiction, and much of later constitutional history is about sustaining the fiction in the face of growing political awareness. Come to my fourth question then, between politics and the constitution. What is the relationship? By the late 18th century, the constitutional concepts I have explained were settled. The sovereignty of Parliament as supreme legislative authority was undisputed. Within the mixed constitution, the House of Commons was in the ascendant. Democracy had a place, a very small place, as I have shown. Parliament represented the people in the sense that it embodies the people, a corporate notion of the people. The real people had no place in the constitution, other than the occasional vote. Having no status or standing, constitutionally they did not exist. Parliament could act in the name of the people while keeping the people out of the way in the constitutional wilderness. And remember, the representatives were not agents or delegates of the electors. They could not be directed or bound by them. But of course, the real people, the final holders of raw political power, as Hume pointed out, cannot be ignored or defined out of existence. Constitutional concepts are fictions, constructions of the mind, of someone's mind. Their purpose is to form institutions and to justify a set of rules for the exercise of political power. In this case, the rule by the few of the many. But Hume again, according to Hume, a constitutional order and the power structure it entrenches has nothing to support it, remember, but opinion. The opinion of the people, the locus of ultimate power. By the 18th century, the people were beginning to question that constitutional order that I have described. We're beginning to question the fictions on which it was based, the power relations it supported. The constitutional arrangements came under scrutiny, the rule of the few under pressure. The question then, as always, was why should the people accept, exercise self-restraint, and curb their natural power with respect to a constitutional order from the engagement with which they were excluded? Why be content with such a mean sense of democracy when across the channel the French were displaying the true power of the people and offering a very different constitutional vision? And yet the British system remained intact. The mixed constitution, with its limited sense of democracy, survived. How and why it survived although in touch and go at times, is a complex matter that I cannot now fully consider, except to comment on one aspect, namely, how the representatives, the parliamentarians, confronted the rise in popular agitation and the consequences for Parliament as the sovereign representative body. The 18th century was the high watermark of parliamentary deliberation on the nature of the constitution and the place of the people. I choose those words carefully, the high watermark of deliberation. Members of the House of Commons, such as Fox, Pitt, and Burke, to name just a few of many, engaged with the central issue in a manner and a seriousness not seen since. The issue was plain, the relationship between Parliament and the people. Although the Constitution was settled, parliamentarians knew it was contingent and fragile, a contingent and fragile settlement. They understood the tension between the constitutional concept of a sovereign representative parliament and a growing political awareness among the people, the real people. But it was adequate and could be justified, but was it adequate and could it be justified in the light of political events at home and abroad? Could it cope with, withstand the demands of a constitutionally conscious people? These were the questions central to the parliamentary debates in the latter part of the 18th century. Within that question of the relationship between people and parliament, three themes were prominent. First, by political necessity, the voice of the people outside parliament had to be heard. Practical issues had to be settled, such as, how should parliament take account of the voice of the people outside parliament, whether expressed at election or by other means? Should Parliament be bound by a clear expression of public opinion? Was Parliament bound by electoral mandates? Or should it reserve the right to act as it thought best? Issues which you can see are still very pertinent. Behind such practical matters and others lay deeper divisions about the merits of the constitutional order. That's the first issue. The second comment is this. Whether the question before the parliamentarians in the late 18th century is whether the democratic element of the constitution ought to be expanded, developed further, a fuller sense of democracy embraced. This was clear in the front of their minds. And thirdly, the final issue was whether the people should be acknowledged as the true seat of sovereignty, and if so, what would be the constitutional consequences? Time allows just a few brief comments, and then I will conclude. Parliamentarians of the time, as I said, demonstrated an understanding of the issues between the people and Parliament, an understanding of equality, in my opinion, unmatched. Influenced perhaps by David Hume, whose writings they would have known, they understood the fragility of constitutional order. They grasped the unavoidable tensions between rule by representatives, aware that they had nothing but popular opinion to support them, and the wish of the people to have more control over their own destinies. Opinions in the House of Commons and the Lords were divided, some arguing the traditional line that sound and effective government was best achieved within the mixed constitution, others that Parliament could no longer resist the wishes of the people. It is true that the results at the end of the 18th century were fairly much to sustain the status quo. The mixed constitution, the notion of Parliament as a sovereign representative authority, a limited franchise, and in general, a minor role for the people. But things could easily have gone the other way. Many argued for a much fuller place for the people, a much stronger notion of democracy. Pitt and Burke were eloquent in defence of the mixed constitution and minimal democracy, partly because it worked well, but partly because history paints a bleak picture of direct democracy, to which the howls of the sovereign French mob ringing through the kingdom were living proof. But for the horrors unfolding before their eyes, the direct result the result parliamentarians reached in discussing constitutional form could have won the day. The reformers came close. Some, like Burke, who had earlier moved tentatively towards much fuller democracy in light of the spectacle of the French experiment, others, like Burke, were driven into obstinate opposition. The French Revolution was a sobering lesson and a major force against constitutional reform. The French influence on British opinion at the time is hard to overstate. Without it, the balance between people and Parliament might have been seriously adjusted. The mixed constitution seemed a safe and reliable refuge from the unpredictability of change. The mixed constitution, after all, allowed the people to influence the course of parliamentary affairs, but without controlling them. Representative government, Pitt urged, ensures, and I quote, conformity of the sentiments of the people and their representatives, unquote. That such platitudes beg the question and are not an accurate description of the relationship hardly mattered in the shadow of the French Revolution. The voices for change were equally eloquent and equally compelling. Fox was consistent over a long parliamentary career in arguing the case for the sovereignty of the people and hence a fuller constitutional role for them. Amongst others of similar mind, one states the view concisely, representative democracy is no democracy at all. To those in favour of the status quo, the founding of another constitutional order at the same time, that of the United States, must have been of some comfort. James Madison, the principal architect, opted for a republic rather than a democracy after weighing the merits of each. In a republic, he said, the people delegate government to a small number of citizens elected by the rest. Its virtue is, and I quote, to refine and enlarge the public views by passing them through the medium of a chosen body of citizens whose wisdom may best discern the true interest of their country and whose patriotism and love of justice will be least likely to sacrifice it to temporary or partial consideration. The consequences may be, concluded Madison, that the public voice, pronounced by the representatives of the people, will be more consonant to the public good than if pronounced by the people themselves. There is no mention here of the British system, but take away monarchy and peers, and Madison's solution to the core constitutional question is essentially the British solution. And now that monarch and peers have been reduced to ornaments, the match is even better. The 19th century and the first part of the 20th are held to be the age of reform. Beginning in 1832 with the Great Reform Act and culminating in the earlier part of the 20th century, a series of acts of Parliament conferred universal adult suffrage. That was a major advance, for the power to elect and remove representatives or governments is a fundamental principle in its own right. It leaves intact, however, the relationship established in the late 18th century between the people and the elected, the representatives. The rise of political parties arguably distanced the people even further from Parliament, but that's for another occasion. To conclude with three brief points. First, you may be wondering why I've said little about the merits of the referendum. Two reasons. One is that while it raises issues particular to itself, it is best approached, I suggest, its merits and demerits best judged within the broader relationship between people and Parliament. The other reason is the referendum is only one among several ways of adding to the people's constitutional position. If reform is in the wind, all ways should be considered. Secondly, nor have I said anything about populism, which is supposed to be sweeping through Europe, the United States, and elsewhere. That has been the subject of a workshop today and tomorrow, to which anyone interested in learning more is invited to attend. If by populism we mean an ideology that separates society into two antagonistic groups, the pure people and the corrupt elite, One consequence is to place the relationship between people and representatives under close scrutiny. Third and final point, the people-parliamentary relationship, anyway, is coming under scrutiny, which is likely to become more intense. All I hope to have shown here is how that relationship came about, how it came to be the foundation of the Constitution of the United Kingdom. It is an historical legacy, a social invention, a response to historical events. Many consider it has contributed well to the creation of a stable and peaceful society, a society of reasonable liberty and tolerance. On other grounds, however, it may have failed. Other needs and aspirations may not have been met. Representative democracy is not the end, not the end of constitutional history, as if somehow, remember we were told that something else was the end of history. Of course, nothing is the end of history. Representative democracy has secured its place in modern societies. It has served societies at various stages in their history. It has produced certain social goods. But societies change. Attitudes of the people change. Perhaps no longer are they content to have a minimal place in the Constitution and hence in the political process. The remedy may be constitutional change, maybe even serious constitutional change. If so, let it be considered and deliberate, not by the ambush of an irresponsible parliament, nor by creeping in the back door like the thief in the night. Thank you.